This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening and welcome. I first learned of Andrew Bacevich when he published his book in 2006 entitled The New American Militarism. And you might know I do a public radio program called Alternative Radio, so I'm always... Thank you. That wasn't an applause line. But I'm a hunter and gatherer. I'm always looking for new voices. And I was very struck by what Andrew Bacevich had to say. And in particular, the following paragraph. The marriage of a militaristic cast of mind with utopian ends is a misbegotten one, contrary to the long-term interests of either the American people or the world beyond our borders. It invites endless war and the ever-deepening militarization of U.S. policy. As it subordinates concern for the common good to the paramount value of military effectiveness, it promises not to perfect but to distort American ideals. As it concentrates ever more authority in the hands of a few more concerned with order abroad rather than with justice at home, it will accelerate the hollowing out of American democracy. As it alienates peoples and nations around the world, it will leave the United States increasingly isolated. If history is any guide, it will end in bankruptcy, moral as well as economic, and in abject failure. And just today, reading the front page of the Santa Fe New Mexican, an article about budget cuts in the school system, and the front page of the New York Times as well, under the cover front page, had a story about hundreds of thousands of American public school teachers are in dire straits and may be laid off very soon. So I think making those connections between the military-industrial complex and what is happening here at home is one of the salient characteristics of Andrew Bacevich's work, and he has been sounding a clarion call for us as a people to pay attention to what is happening to our foreign policy and how that impacts on domestic policy as well. And I just want to share one other thing with you that Andrew Bacevich wrote in August of 2008. Will the next president actually bring about big change? Don't get your hopes up. The very structure of American politics imposes its own constraints. A President Obama, even if his own party runs the Senate and House, won't enjoy all that much latitude. He will encounter the three areas in which the dead hand of the past weighs most heavily: defense policy, energy policy, and the Arab-Israeli peace process. So here we see, again, Andrew Bacevich, I think, positioning himself in as a very rigorous historian, a critic, but someone who can really see that the structures and institutions in the United States basically are extremely difficult to move and to mold. So I'm looking forward to this evening. I hope you are as well. There'll be a book signing after the event. And please give a warm Santa Fe welcome to Andrew Bacevich.
Well, it's a real privilege for me to come back to speak here. I know that the Lannan Foundation does an awful lot for this community, but I really feel it's important for me to acknowledge how important the Lannan Foundation's support has been for me and for my work. So I'm just tremendously grateful. I listened to that quote from things I wrote a couple years ago, and sometimes I think that I keep writing the same thing over and over again. I hope that's not true, and I hope that you won't find my presentation this evening too repetitive. The title of the talk is Sacred Trinity, and the purpose of the presentation really is to invite you all to think about a set of first principles that have for decades now informed the making of U.S. national security policy, and that, at least in my judgment, have come to be counterproductive and pernicious. Now, for those who seek to capture the essential truths of contemporary American politics, differences are interesting, but it's the continuities that are really instructive. What really matters is not what changes when Republicans give way to Democrats or when President Obama succeeds President Bush. No, what really matters are the things that stay the same. And this evening I want to talk to you about the continuities that have defined and today still continue to define the post-war tradition of U.S. national security strategy. Let's call this tradition the Washington Rules. The Washington Rules combine two elements, each one deeply embedded in the American collective consciousness. We take them as given. They've long since become part of our national wallpaper. Like Memorial Day, marking the unofficial start of summer, or Labor Day, signifying its end, the Washington Rules number among the things we choose to believe, not because they are true, but because they are expedient, or at least we think they are. The first element, the first part of the Washington Rules, consists of a series of assertions about how the international order ought to work, along with the role assigned to the United States to ensure that the order functions as intended. Call this the Credo. Speaking to the throngs gathered in Chicago's Grant Park, on the night of his election to the presidency, Barack Obama signaled his allegiance to this credo when he summoned his fellow citizens, quote, to put their hands on the arc of history and bend it once more toward the hope of a better day. That history follows a discernible direction, and that Americans are called upon to determine its trajectory are propositions that Obama's listeners likely took for granted. Americans have long since become accustomed to their leaders asserting such claims. Now, bending the arc of history necessarily entails vast exertions on a sustained basis. It implies a capacity to discern the arc's proper shape. It implies not only the possession of great power, but also a willingness to extend that power to ensure the accomplishment of history's purposes. In what was billed as her first major foreign policy address, Hillary Clinton, President Obama's Secretary of State, made the point explicitly, citing with approval the famous words of the revolutionary-era radical Tom Paine, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again." Remember, this was one of Ronald Reagan's favorite quotations. Hillary Clinton went on to declare that, quote, "Today we are called upon to use that power." Susan Rice, President Obama's ambassador to the United Nations, was quick to chime in a speech that she made, announcing that, quote, "The change that has come to America can also change the world." In a speech intended to highlight how much American statecraft had changed now that the White House was under fresh occupancy, Rice managed instead to highlight the essentials that had remained the same. In today's world, more than ever, Rice announced, America's interests and our values converge. Well, just 4 years earlier, George W. Bush had let it known that, quote, America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. According to Rice, America's security and well-being are inextricably linked to those of people everywhere. Or as President Bush had put it back in 2005, the survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. The emphasis may have shifted from liberation to uplift, but the Obama team's ambitions and expectations were hardly less grandiose than those of the previous administration. President Bush had vowed to eliminate evil and spread freedom. Ambassador Rice promised that President Obama would, quote, grow the ranks of capable democratic states. America, she said, was going to, quote, reduce poverty, disease, and hunger, to end preventable deaths of mothers and children, and to build self-sufficiency in agriculture, health, and education. End of quote. Now, this self-admiring vision constitutes the essence of what Americans understand by the phrase global leadership. In his speech at Grant Park, Barack Obama was implicitly affirming his commitment to all that is signified by that phrase. Secretary Clinton and Ambassador Rice reinforced that commitment. Change was coming to America, but change did not mean that the United States was about to shirk its responsibilities. On the contrary, it would continue to lead. Or as Ambassador Rice put it, quote, the United States is back. Now, since taking office, President Obama and his administration have acted on many fronts to adjust the way that the United States exercises that leadership. Yet these adjustments have seldom risen above the tactical. When it comes to fundamentals, the administration has stood firm, the credo to which every president since 1945 has subscribed persists. On this score, change has not come to America. This credo derives from four convictions as firmly lodged in present-day Washington as they were 60 years ago. According to the first of those convictions, the world must be organized or shaped, the alternative being chaos. Second, only the United States possesses the capacity to perform this shaping function. No other nation possesses the vision, will, and wisdom required to lead. Apart from America, no other nation, and certainly no supranational institution, forget the UN, ought to be entrusted with that role. Third, rogues and recalcitrants apart, everyone understands and accepts this reality. Despite pro forma grumbling, therefore, the world wants the United States to serve as global leader. Fourth and finally, America's writ, therefore, includes the charge of specifying and enforcing the principles that should define the international order. Those principles are necessarily American principles, which possess universal validity. Now, the fact that specific American principles are in a constant state of flux in no way compromises their universality. However much American attitudes regarding nuclear weapons or non-combatant casualties or race or women's rights may change, the most recent articulation of principle is the one that counts and the one to which others are expected to conform. Mainstream Republicans and mainstream Democrats are equally devoted to this catechism. Within Washington, this concept of American global leadership qualifies as dogma. Little empirical evidence is available to demonstrate its validity, yet when it comes to matters of faith, proof is unnecessary. Adherence to the credo, by definition, has become a matter of faith. In simplest terms, the credo summons the United States and the United States alone to lead, save, liberate, and ultimately transform the world, bringing history to its intended destination, namely the universal triumph of freedom. In a celebrated manifesto issued at the dawn of what he termed the American century, the publisher Henry Luce, made the case for this spacious conception of global leadership. This is an article published in Life magazine, February 1941. Luce, in this essay, exhorted his fellow citizens to, quote, accept wholeheartedly our duty to exert upon the world the full impact of our influence for such purposes as we see fit and by such means as we see fit. And in this one sentence, Luce captured what remains even today the credo's essence. Luce's concept of an American century, an age of unquestioned American dominion, resonated, especially in Washington. His evocative phrase stuck and embedded itself in the lexicon of national politics. Not for nothing did the neoconservatives, who in the 1990s were lobbying for more militant U.S. policies, dub their enterprise the Project for a New American Century. So too did Luce's expansive claim of the prerogatives to be exercised by the United States. Even today, whenever public figures allude to America's responsibility to lead, they are signaling their fidelity to the credo, which, along with respectful allusions to God and the troops, has become a prerequisite for high office. But recall that Luce's articulation of America's duty has two components. It's not only up to Americans, he wrote, to choose the purposes for which they would bring their influence to bear, but to choose the means as well. And here we confront the second element of the post-war tradition of American statecraft, part two of the Washington Rules. With regard to means, the Washington Rules have emphasized activism over example, hard power over soft, and coercion, often styled as negotiating from a position of strength, over suasion. The exercise of global leadership, as prescribed by the credo, obliges the United States to maintain military capabilities far in excess of those required for self-defense. Indeed, self-defense, per se, barely qualifies as an afterthought. Again, mainstream Republicans and mainstream Democrats are committed to the proposition that fulfilling America's responsibility to lead implies the availability of coercive power and a willingness to use that power. Americans take for granted the existence of this approach to global leadership and are therefore blind to its significance. They also take for granted the triad of military principles to which Washington adheres in translating intent into action. And here I'm really getting to what I think is the heart of the presentation to this discussion of this triad of principles. Recall that prior to World War II, Americans by and large had viewed military power and military institutions with skepticism, if not outright hostility. In the wake of World War II, all that changed. An affinity for military might emerged as central to the American identity. By the midpoint of the 20th century, the Pentagon had ceased to be a mere building. Like Wall Street at the end of the 19th century, it had become Leviathan, its actions veiled in secrecy, its reach extending around the world. Yet whereas the concentration of power in Wall Street evoked and still evokes fear and suspicion, Americans by and large accepted the concentration of power in the Pentagon as benign. Most, not all, judged this new military ascendancy to be both necessary and reassuring. A people who had long viewed standing armies as a threat to liberty now came to believe that the preservation of liberty required them to lavish resources on their armed forces. During the Cold War, Americans worried ceaselessly about falling behind the Russians, even though the Pentagon consistently maintained a position of overall primacy. Once the Soviet threat disappeared, however, mere primacy no longer sufficed. amidst claims emanating from Washington that the world was becoming more dangerous than ever. And this was years before 9/11. Unquestioned military supremacy now emerged as the essential predicate to global leadership. The United States now laid claim to the status of sole superpower, the Pentagon committing itself to achieving what it called full spectrum dominance. Now, every great military power has its distinctive signature. For Napoleonic France, it was the levée en masse, the people in arms, animated by the ideals of the French Revolution. For Great Britain, in the heyday of its empire, the signature was command of the seas, sustained by a dominant fleet and a network of far-flung outposts from Gibraltar and the Cape of Good Hope to Singapore and Hong Kong. For Germany, from the 1860s to the 1940s, and for Israel, from 1948 to 1973, the signature was superiority in the conduct of combined arms warfare, a potent blend of toughness, flexibility, and operational audacity. The abiding signature of American military power since World War II has been of a different order altogether. The United States has not specialized in any one particular type of war. Its armed forces have not adhered to a fixed style. No single service or weapon has enjoyed consistent favor. At times, the military has relied on citizen soldiers to fill its ranks. At other times, like today, the military has shown a preference for long service professionals. Yet an examination of the past 60 years of U.S. military policy and practice does reveal important elements of continuity. Call them the sacred trinity. An abiding conviction that the minimum essentials of international peace and security require the United States and the United States alone, first, to maintain a global military presence, second, to configure its forces for global power projection, and third, to use those forces to support a policy of global interventionism. I want to take a couple of minutes to map this trinity and to explain how it functions. Let's start with global military presence. Simply put, U.S. forces occupy bases around the world. They do so on what can only be termed a permanent basis in the United Kingdom and Germany, in Spain and Italy, in Japan and South Korea, in the Persian Gulf and the Horn of Africa, in Central Asia and the Western Pacific. There are literally hundreds of U.S. military facilities scattered around the globe, many of them small, several dozen of them very large indeed, none of them unimportant. Not long ago, Vice Admiral Arthur Sobrowski, an influential military thinker, described these facilities as, quote, nodes or hubs in a worldwide system of moving U.S. military forces anywhere we need them to go. Note that the system's purpose is not to defend any one place, but to provide decision makers with the flexibility to deploy U.S. military power virtually anywhere. This worldwide system of nodes and hubs, an empire of bases, in Chalmers Johnson's apt phrase, is not fixed. It is instead in continuous flux, adapting to reigning or emerging strategic priorities. When I was a serving officer back in the Cold War, Western Europe and Northeast Asia constituted the twin poles of this empire. Today, the Persian Gulf and Central Asia occupy center stage. The empire also includes what we might call mobile nodes, endowing the United States with the capability to position assets wherever they might be needed. I refer here to the Navy's carrier strike groups and the Marine expeditionary units that are always afloat, positioned to demonstrate U.S. concern or anticipation of actual employment. As important as bases, whether fixed or mobile, are the agreements that the United States negotiates with various countries to permit access to ports or airfields in the event of various contingencies, or to allow U.S. military aircraft to overfly their territory. All of these agreements facilitating the employment of U.S. military power in places that might otherwise be inaccessible. The crown jewel in this empire of bases may well be Diego Garcia, a British-owned, U.S.-leased property in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Diego Garcia possesses essentially no economic value. Unlike, say, Gibraltar, it does not sit astride a significant maritime choke point. It is quite literally in the middle of nowhere. Yet its strategic value is incalculable. To convert Diego Garcia into a military base back in the 1970s, the United States and Great Britain collaborated in expelling its inhabitants. Since then, the island has acquired an importance akin to that of Singapore back in the heyday of British power. Although there are no combat forces stationed in Diego Garcia, the United States maintains a small fleet of ships there, uploaded with equipment needed to facilitate intervention by air and ground forces anywhere in this region. The island provides an important link in the Pentagon's network of strategic communications. There is a large airfield, its runway long enough to accommodate the space shuttle, if need be. The airfield serves as a transit point. At least two post-9/11 rendition flights stopped in Diego Garcia to refuel, and it serves as a staging area for airstrikes. During operations Desert Storm, Enduring Freedom, and Iraqi Freedom, long-range bombers operated out of Diego Garcia to attack targets in Iraq and Afghanistan. So if you want to visit one place that might best capture the essence of the U.S. global military presence, Diego Garcia would be that place. Except you can't go there. Apart from a third world contract labor force that maintains the place, Diego Garcia is off limits to civilians. Let's turn to the second element of the Sacred Trinity, namely the practice of configuring U.S. forces for purposes of power projection rather than to defend the United States. Recall that the Bush administration responded to 9/11 by creating a new cabinet agency, the Department of Homeland Security, to assume responsibility for protecting the United States from any further attack. The focus of the inappropriately named Department of Defense remained elsewhere. Indeed, near the very top of the long things that 9/11 did not change is the de facto mission of the Department of Defense. The Pentagon has never wavered from the conviction that its fundamental purpose is to fight out there rather than giving serious attention to protecting us back here. Perhaps the best known U.S. Army post in the continental United States is Fort Hood, located in central Texas, between Dallas and San Antonio. Fort Hood is home to probably the largest concentration of armored vehicles on the face of the earth, two full divisions, a core headquarters, and a host of support units. Look up fort in your dictionary, and you'll find a definition that goes something like this: a building or place fortified for defensive or protective purposes. Yet Fort Hood does not exist to defend Texas from invasion. It doesn't protect anything, not even nearby Killeen. Fort Hood, instead, is a reservoir of combat capability on which policymakers in Washington draw to dispatch soldiers to fight in distant places like Iraq and Afghanistan. Everything that happens at Fort Hood, the way units train and equip, the contingency plans that commanders study and hone, derives from the expectation that the central rationale of the United States military of the United States military exists to fight out there, wherever out there may happen to be. Almost 9 years into the Afghanistan war, it has become almost impossible for us to appreciate how extraordinary it is that U.S. forces should find themselves bogged down in a war on the steppes of Central Asia. I've made repeated efforts to get my students at Boston University to see the Afghanistan war as something other than a routine event. It's not a ho-hum occasion. It's not like the Red Sox or the Patriots or the Celtics winning a world championship. But I've failed time and time again. Perhaps it's understandable. After all, today's undergraduates were preteens when 9/11 occurred. All they have known since becoming conscious of politics is that U.S. forces are actively engaged in combat operations somewhere on the other part of the world. They have been conditioned to take war for granted. To illustrate the extent to which power projection has become the design parameter that determines the character and configuration of U.S. forces, let us consider the way that outer space is emerging as a Pentagon priority. Contemplate this brief quotation. Quote, "Unimpeded access to and use of space is essential for protecting U.S. national security and promoting our prosperity. U.S. space policy is to promote development of the full range of space-based capabilities in a manner that protects our vital security interests. We will deter threats to our interests. And if deterrence fails, defeat hostile efforts against U.S. access to and use of space." Who wrote that? Crazed neoconservatives? Dick Cheney? Donald Rumsfeld? No, it comes from a document called A National Security Strategy for a New Century, published in October 1998 under the signature of President Bill Clinton, although I dare say expressing sentiments that Cheney and Rumsfeld would certainly endorse. Put simply, the Pentagon views unimpeded access to outer space as an essential predicate to projecting U.S. power on land, in the atmosphere, and on and under the seas. Therefore, the United States must develop the ability to project its power into space itself in order to gain control of this so-called ultimate high ground. Now, please ask yourself how Washington would react if officials in Beijing or Moscow made similar statements describing the minimum essential requirements of Chinese or Russian national security. Coming from others, U.S. officials would see such claims as persuasive evidence of megalomania or something much worse. Finally, let us turn to the Sacred Trinity's third element, which manifests itself in a penchant for intervention. Marrying global presence to global power projection capabilities and thereby fulfilling the expectations of the American credo of global leadership. Now, I happen to be a Vietnam veteran, and I mention that only by way of admitting that, like many others of my generation, I tend to attribute to the Vietnam War enormous significance, in all likelihood, more significance than that war actually deserves. In other words, Vietnam colors the lens through which I view the world. That said, it's becoming increasingly obvious that the further Vietnam recedes into the past, the more it becomes an event, it turns out to be an event once thought to be a watershed, but that is anything but that. Considered in retrospect, what distinguishes the legacy of Vietnam is not how much things changed as a result of that war, but how little. Seldom has a war been so fervently memorialized, even as it was being so thoroughly drained of meaning. Defeat in Vietnam seemingly left the Sacred Trinity in tatters. Americans, back in the early 1970s, had had a bellyful of war. That within 5 years of Saigon's fall, the Trinity was well on its way to recovery, therefore, qualifies as remarkable. That within another decade, the so-called Vietnam syndrome, a reluctance to use force except in extremis, that within another decade, the Vietnam syndrome had all but vanished and had given way to a new era of unprecedented interventionism deserves to be seen as astonishing. How exactly did this happen? Well, American elites, both civilian and military, reacted to defeat in Vietnam, much as German elites, both civilian and military, had reacted to defeat in the Great War of 1914-1918. Priority number one was to identify scapegoats. In both countries, stab-in-the-back theories flourished. Jews and leftists being blamed in Germany, liberals, academics, and a putatively biased media being singled out for abuse in the United States. Priority number two was to begin the hard work of reversing the war's apparent verdict. In both countries, this effort met with considerable success, at least in the near term. In the case of both Germany and the United States, a bitter defeat thought to mark a historical turning point turned out to be nothing of the sort. 15 years after the armistice of 1918, Germany was back, its ambitions bigger than ever, its confidence in the German soldier restored. 15 years after the fall of Saigon, the same could be said of the United States. By 1990, Washington had reasserted its claims to global leadership. Indeed, as the Cold War wound down, those claims became all the more expansive. Having seemingly vanquished all challengers, Washington saw no reason not to flex its muscles. By 1990, Americans were well on their way to rediscovering the allure of a global military presence, of forces configured for global power projection, and for policies emphasizing global interventionism. In this sense, Vietnam had been rendered irrelevant. How to explain this turnaround? Well, a large measure of credit belongs to those who bent themselves to the task of discerning and then interpreting the lessons of failure. In post-1918 Germany, that work fell primarily to the officer corps, which reached conclusions that meshed, for a time, with the ambitions of the ascendant Nazi Party. In the United States after Vietnam, the search for lessons also preoccupied the officer corps, which reached conclusions that proved compatible, for a time, with the views of the permanent foreign policy establishment. In the end, though, the views of the officer corps, both German and American soldiers were intent on restoring the prestige and autonomy of the military profession. In the end, their views mattered less than the views of civilian elites. Elite concerned elevated one issue above all others: damage limitation to facilitate restoring the status quo ante bellum, repealing the outcome decided on the field of battle. True in Germany during the 1920s, this was true as well in the United States during the 1970s. Rejecting the claims made by the most ardent critics of the war back in the 1960s, the defenders of the Washington rules insisted that Vietnam signified nothing essential about the United States as such. The policies that had landed this country in that war had not revealed, they said, any large truths about American values or the American system. Certainly mistakes were made with Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, and General William C. Westmoreland singled out as favorite villains. And it was important to identify those mistakes lest they be repeated. But that was about it. Washington asked itself if the Vietnam War had called into question the Washington rules. And Washington replied with a resounding no. Let me illustrate the point by citing views expressed by Anthony Lake in a post-Vietnam lessons learned project sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Lake, as many of you know, later served as the National Security Advisor during President Clinton's first term. 2 decades earlier, he had resigned in a huff from a position in the Nixon White House protesting against the Vietnam War, which had given him what passes in Washington as a reputation for integrity. Yet as early as 1976, that's just 1 year after the fall of Saigon, Lake was warning of a new danger. As a result of Vietnam, he worried that the United States might succumb to what he called, quote, a mean-spirited foreign policy, reminiscent of the period between the world wars. He worried that, quote, a Vietnam analogy could amend or replace the Munich analogy, his words, with Americans concluding that, quote, the United States should avoid foreign wars not by nipping them in the bud, but simply by staying out of them. Well, events soon demonstrated that Lake need not have stayed up nights worrying about the United States avoiding wars. With the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, interventionism, third element of the Sacred Trinity, began its return to fashion. Reinforced during the administration of the elder Bush, especially as a consequence of the first Persian Gulf War, and then endowed with a seal of bipartisanship during the Clinton era, before finally reaching its apotheosis after 9/11, when a determination to nip wars in the bud found expression in the infamous Bush Doctrine of Preventive War. To sum up, then, Credo and Trinity, the one defining purpose, the other practice, constitute the essence of the way that Washington has attempted to govern and to police the American century. The relationship between the two is symbiotic. The Trinity lends plausibility to the Credo's vast claims. The Credo, in turn, justifies the Trinity's vast requirements and exertions. Together, they describe an enduring consensus that assigns a consistent azimuth to U.S. policy, regardless of which political party may hold the upper hand or who may be occupying the White House. From the era of Harry Truman to the age of Barack Obama, this consensus has remained intact. It defines the rules to which Washington adheres. It determines the precepts by which Washington has sought to rule. Well, so what? Why not celebrate, or at least accept the Credo and the Trinity, and promote them as a way to extend the life of the American century for at least another century, if not two or three? Well, the answer is simply this. The Washington rules have become obsolete. They no longer work as intended. To persist in our allegiance to the Credo and the Trinity is to pursue a path of willful self-destruction. The Washington rules were forged at a moment
when American influence and power had reached their acme. That moment has now passed. The United States has depleted the stores of authority and goodwill it had acquired by 1945. Words uttered in Washington no longer command automatic deference or even respect. Americans can ill afford to indulge any longer in dreams of saving the world or of remaking it in our own image. Bluntly speaking, the curtain has rung down on the American century. Similarly, the United States no longer possesses sufficient wherewithal to sustain a national security strategy that relies on global military presence and global power projection to underwrite a policy of global interventionism. Touted as essential to peace, adherence to that strategy has propelled the United States into a condition approximating perpetual war, as the military misadventures of the past decade have demonstrated. As a consequence, we are well on our way to breaking the bank, and we may yet break the force as well. To anyone with eyes to see, the shortcomings inherent in the Washington rules have become self-evident. Although those most deeply invested in perpetuating those rules will insist otherwise, the fact is that the tradition to which Washington remains devoted has begun to unravel. Attempting to prolong its existence might serve Washington's interests, but it will not serve the interests of the American people. Now, devising an alternative to the reigning national security paradigm will pose a daunting challenge, especially if Americans look to Washington for fresh thinking. Yet the imperative of replacing that paradigm may yet offer the key to our salvation. In one sense, the national security policies to which Washington continues to adhere express what has long been the preferred American approach to engaging the world beyond our borders, that approach playing to our presumed strong suit, commonly thought to be military might. In another sense, however, those policies have enabled the United States to avoid serious engagement. Confidence in American arms, making it unnecessary to attend to what others might think or to consider how their aspirations might differ from our own. In this regard, the Washington rules serve to reinforce American provincialism, a tendency for which the United States continues to pay dearly. Worse still, however, the persistence of these rules has also provided Americans an excuse to avoid serious self-engagement. From this perspective, confidence that the credo and the Trinity will oblige others to accommodate themselves to our needs or desires, whether for cheap oil, cheap credit, or cheap consumer goods, this confidence has allowed the United States to ignore or defer problems demanding attention here at home. Fixing Iraq or Afghanistan ends up taking precedence over fixing Cleveland and Detroit. Purporting to support the troops in their crusade to free the world obviates any obligation to assess the actually existing exercise of freedom here at home. When Americans demonstrate a willingness to engage seriously with others, combined with the courage to engage seriously with themselves, the possibility of devising new rules, American rules, rather than Washington rules, just might present itself. With that, I'll stop, and I thank you very much for your attention.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, I feel I've almost been in a religious session with the terminology of catechism and credos and faith and dogma, and there is certainly something to that. Gore Vidal once said a few years ago that we live in the USA, the United States of amnesia. And history is largely forgotten or not even taught. You are a historian. I'm interested to see the parallels between Saigon in 1963 and Kabul in 2010, with problematic allies, with corruption rife, with leaders who are deeply unpopular among their own population, and in fact, brothers who are directly implicated in drug trafficking, with Nodin Diem, his brother, and with Hamid Karzai, his brother, Wali. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on 63 Saigon and 2010 Kabul.
I think the most important thing that comparing those circumstances reminds me of is how we deceive ourselves in thinking that as the sole superpower forging relations with a country that we frankly view as a client, how limited our leverage actually proves to be, and how in a perverse way we almost become the client of the smaller state and find ourselves boxed in, and once boxed in, tending to do stupid things. I mean, in 1963, President Kennedy and his administration had very much up the ante with regard to the American commitment to South Vietnam, well beyond what had been begun by President Eisenhower. And Vice President Lyndon Johnson had famously traveled to Saigon and publicly proclaimed that President Diem was the Churchill of Asia. The problem was that Diem was both ineffective and uncooperative. And as the U.S. military presence grew in size and in demands, Diem became increasingly resentful and resistant to following American orders, so much so that the U.S. intelligence agencies at least believed that Diem and his brother would be willing to cut a deal with the National Liberation Front, and potentially with North Vietnam, to get the Americans out and have Vietnam's problems be solved by Vietnamese. That prospect was viewed so with such alarm by the people in the Kennedy administration that what follows was U.S. complicity in a coup that overthrew Diem, led to his murder, and then produced chaos in South Vietnam. It made it that much more difficult to get out. And what we have today is, to some degree, a comparable situation with President Karzai. The more we impose demands, the larger our presence becomes. Seemingly, the less cooperative he is becoming, the more nationalistic, to the point where, I think a week ago, he sort of threw out the comment, maybe I'll reconcile with the Taliban. Now, I'm not trying to suggest to you that therefore the Obama administration is plotting Karzai's overthrow, although that's possible. I am saying that that's suggestive of the extent to which when we make these commitments and invest such enormous resources, we find ourselves in this perverse situation where our options become ever narrower and ever less desirable.
I've been spending quite a bit of time in Pakistan over the last few years, and I've been to Afghanistan as well, and I can report that the great expansion of these bombing attacks, the drones, on Pakistan has generated an enormous amount of hostility, animosity, loathing for the United States. And Obama has greatly expanded the war in Pakistan, a country with acute internal problems that is in danger of unraveling. What might you think is motivating Obama? And again, to go back into history, you'll remember that Nixon used the sanctuary arguments in the late 1960s and early 1970s to expand the Vietnam War into Cambodia and to Laos.
It's very perplexing. I was in the camp that interpreted his hawkish rhetoric during the campaign, specifically with regard to Afghanistan, as designed to protect himself from the typical charge directed at liberal Democrats that they're national security wimps. You know, he was the anti-Iraq war candidate, and he needed to nonetheless project an image of toughness, and posturing toward Afghanistan allowed him to do that. And yet, all of his actions since becoming president suggest that that wasn't simply about politics. And I find it perplexing. I find his decision to escalate in Afghanistan perplexing. I find the ever-increasing U.S. military involvement in Pakistan perplexing, both because the Afghanistan war makes no strategic sense in my judgment, and because U.S. activities in Afghanistan and Pakistan are serving to destabilize Pakistan, not make the place more stable. So why is the president doing these things? My two speculative answers would be, number one, he has surrounded himself with very orthodox and conventional thinkers with regard to national security. And I think he's probably getting advice that very much is consistent with the kind of notions that I was talking about. You know, when you got a retired four-star Marine as a national security advisor, you got a retired four-star officer as director of national intelligence, you carry over your Secretary of Defense from the previous administration, and when you appoint Hillary Clinton, who is no dove, as Secretary of State, you're not likely to get a wide range of views on issues. That's answer number one. Answer number two is even more speculative, and that is that presidents can't do all things, and if this president, in essence, decided that domestic reform was going to be his first-term priority, he might have chosen to kick national security issues down the road to a second term, and in essence, to reinforce the status quo with regard to national security. And that's kind of, I mean, the decisions he's made with regard to Afghanistan and Pakistan are exactly the same decisions that John McCain would have made had we elected John McCain president. There's no difference at all.
And in fact, you identified that in that LA Times op-ed piece that I read in my introduction. That, you know, don't expect much. It's going to be pretty much business as usual because of these patterns that are deeply entrenched in the American state.
Well, there's another issue, specific issue here, I think, that has to do with the relative balance between senior officers and senior civilian officials. And when President Bush in 2006 announced his so-called surge and appointed General Petraeus to implement that policy, and when the surge produced results which, in my judgment, fall well short of anything constituting a victory, but which nonetheless prevented outright defeat in Iraq, the result of that was to, I think, greatly enhance the political clout of the officer corps, or at least certain members.
specifically Petraeus, and by extension, the guy who has become Petraeus's deputy, not in an official sense, General McChrystal, so that they are the principal uniformed advocates of this notion that counterinsurgency should constitute the new American way of war, and that the success achieved in Iraq can be replicated in Afghanistan and presumably elsewhere. And I think that given the amount of influence that somebody like General Petraeus has acquired, that also makes it that much more difficult for any president to say we're not going to go that way.
When generals like Petraeus and McChrystal testify in front of Congress, they get very deferential treatment. They're almost treated like rock stars. I remember a few years ago when Cokie Roberts of National Public Radio said whenever she sees someone in uniform with a lot of medals, she just starts to melt. That's the liberal National Public Radio. You, in a conversation with Bill Moyers a couple of Fridays ago, were very critical of McChrystal and what he is doing in Afghanistan. And I was wondering if these were just tactical differences you have with U.S. policy and U.S. commanders, or is it something deeper about overall strategies and what the country is doing in South Asia, in West Asia?
If I would give you a two-minute lesson on global military history since 1945, it says 1315 right now, left. Hiroshima seemed to prove that war was senseless, that force could no longer be used purposefully to advance a political agenda. By extension, that meant that the military profession no longer had any claim to status and stature. So the officer corps, after 1945, set out to reinvent war and to prove that war still worked, to prove that force could be employed without destroying civilization to achieve political purposes at a reasonable cost. In particular, the post-Vietnam officer corps of this country was devoted to that proposition, was devoted to the notion that battle works, that in a collision between opposing armies, the outcome of that collision would quickly determine a political outcome. And indeed, the American officer corps and many Americans interpreted Operation Desert Storm back in 1991 as validating this notion. We sent our soldiers to Saudi Arabia. They beat up Saddam Hussein's army. They liberated Kuwait. They quickly came home. We had parades. That conception of warfare informed the planning of both the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq. And initially, in both places, events seemed to once again affirm that model. But in Iraq and then in Afghanistan, the model collapsed. We didn't get decision in Iraq. What we got was a long, drawn-out, protracted, inconclusive, incredibly costly, and incredibly ugly struggle. So what the American officer corps then did, and this is where Petraeus's influence is so significant, they abandoned the idea that battle works. You don't hear McChrystal or Petraeus talk about gaining a military victory. What you hear them talking now, they sound more like the social reformer Jane Addams than they sound like George Patton. They talk about how eliminating corruption and creating good governance and encouraging economic development and protecting the rights of women, that that is going to be the way by which the United States is going to achieve its political purposes. That doesn't happen through battle. It doesn't happen quickly. It doesn't happen easily. It happens through these incredibly long, drawn-out, complicated imperial adventures. That, to me, is one of the most striking things that's happened. This abandonment of traditional thinking about warfare by the officer corps is one of the most striking things I think that's happened in recent memory. That took 4 minutes. I'm sorry.
I'm interested and gratified that you use the adjective imperial, something that the media in general refrained from using when talking about U.S. policy. Well, starting with John Winthrop's City on the Hill and Reagan's rhetoric of the 80s, Madeleine Albright, America is the indispensable nation. This notion of American exceptionalism seems also to be very deep-rooted in Washington rules, that somehow through this magic of divine providence or something called history has caused the United States to be put in this position. What about, reversing some of these notions with some different kind of way of thinking that's more imaginative and creative and is more realistic in terms of realities that the U.S. is facing today?
Well, that's where I think it's where we teachers have to be conscious of how difficult the challenge we face and perhaps how poorly we have faced up to this challenge. I mean, it is not as if there are no critical treatments of American history. I mean, earlier this afternoon, we were talking about Howard Zinn's recent passing. I mean, his People's History of the United States, I think, has sold over 2 million copies. What's striking is the extent to which none of that really sticks, that there seems to be some kind of a hardwired sort of preference for a different version of American history that is one in which we don't want to think seriously about the past. And that's where you were sort of jabbing me about using religiously loaded language in the talk, and I do that consciously. It's actually my little evangelical thing. I'm trying to promote Catholicism in my own little way.
It's a tough sell these days.
It's a very tough sell these days. Man. But I think that the religious language, in a sense, is appropriate because this notion of American exceptionalism does have a religious aspect to it. And therefore, it is immune to empirical evidence. Now, the politicians reinforce it. That's why I began with that quote from President Obama, that they constantly reinforce this notion of American chosenness, of American specialness, of an American mission, of America's ability to discern history's purposes. But it's not fair to put all the blame on them because they say that because they say those things because they're saying things that they are confident we want to hear. And so you get this endless self-perpetuating process. It's an insidious thing.
And as a member of the media, I have to, solicit your views on what role the media play in constructing the popular views toward what's happening.
I think until recently, I have not been a very critical observer of the mainstream media. But increasingly, I've now begun to grasp the extent to which, the Times, the Post, the network news organizations do tend, in a way, to amplify whatever the conventional wisdom is in Washington. I mean, they do it in ways that are not obvious. I mean, they make a sort of a pretense of asking questions. But if Washington says that the three most important issues of the day are A, B, and C, then ABC is going to report that the three most important issues of the day are A, B, and C. And I think that, I mean, your reference to the unwillingness to use terms like imperial, to view U.S. policy through the lens of empire, which the New York Times would never touch, you know, maybe an occasional op-ed, but in terms of a framework for reporting, I think is indicative of the way that they fail us. They are themselves part of the establishment, the people who run the networks, who run the papers, frankly, want to be part of the establishment. They want to go to the cocktail parties. They want to imagine that, you know, Rahm Emanuel actually cares what they think, and he will try to make sure that they think that he cares what they think.
You have embedded journalism, literally, today.
Right.
Journalists in bed with political elites. That must be uncomfortable. Chalmers Johnson, whom you referred to in your presentation, has compared the United States today, of course, all historical situations are not identical or analogous, but with Rome in terms of wars that are being fought in far-off places that are draining the national treasury, increasing immiseration and pauperization of the population at home. What kind of credence do you give to that kind of analysis?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all sort of push back a little bit, don't want to carry those kind of analogies too far, but I think you can make the case for American decline without making a comparison with Rome. Just the absolute refusal to live within our means is something that, to my way of thinking, cannot persist indefinitely. And I think, frankly, most of us know that. But most of us are unwilling to make the sacrifices in the way we live that will be required to restore some sense of equilibrium. And again, you know, you can blame Madison Avenue for bombarding us with messages about all the stupid trinkets that we supposedly have to be happy. But at the end of the day, I don't think we can absolve ourselves of responsibility. We collectively, as citizens of a republic.
And what can't last doesn't last. It's interesting that Obama, in his State of the Union address, lectured the country on living within its means, like a family would live within a budget, at the same time announcing a fairly significant increase in the military budget. The Pentagon seems to be immune from the austerity that is being demanded in other government departments, like education, which I referred to in my opening comments.
Well, it's politically difficult to do that. It would take political courage
to cut the Pentagon budget.
Well, and you know, you don't begin by saying, I mean, to my mind, you wouldn't begin by saying, I'm the president, I've decided the budget's too big. I think you begin by saying, I'm the president, and I've contemplated the trajectory of U.S. national security policy over the last 60 years, and we're going in the wrong direction. We are adhering to principles that are false. And I'm going to articulate a new set of principles. And based on those new set of principles, it'd be quite likely that you would not require
the level of military spending that we now take for granted. So you begin with the policy and the principles, and then you get to the budget.
Well, it seems that Washington is now positioning China as the looming threat, China, which recently became the number one exporter in the world. It is poised to pass Japan as the number two economy in the world and pass the United States within several decades. It's clearly China is on the ascendancy, while U.S. power and influence is waning. What do you hear from your contacts in the military about a potential confrontation with China?
I really don't have very many contacts. I don't keep touch with people.
To you.
No, but I mean, clearly there are those who believe that there is a confrontation looming just beyond the horizon with this rising power. And I must say, I'm very skeptical of that. That it may end up being a self-fulfilling prophecy if we're stupid. But I'm not a China expert. I've only been to China once. The rate of change has to be seen to be believed. But B, the problems they have domestically are mammoth: demographic problems, environmental problems, problems of maldistribution of development.
Minority issues.
It's not as if everything is hunky-dory, but more importantly, I think, is what has China historically aspired to be as a power? And I think I'm safe in saying they have never aspired to be the global hegemon. They have never expressed a determination to have Chinese values prevail around the world. We do that. So I'm sure that the Chinese will be a great power, that they will demand to be treated with respect, as the respect deserving a great power. I'm sure that there will be times and places where our interests and their interests are going to not coincide. But the notion that somehow we should gear ourselves up for some great competition with the Chinese to see who's going to control the world strikes me as really stupid.
Andrew Bacevich will be signing his books, The New American Militarism and Limits of Power, in the lobby, Garcia Books. Your locally independent bookstore is here, so we'll see you in the lobby, and look out for Andrew Bacevich's new book entitled Washington Rules. It'll be out in early August from Holt. Thanks very much for coming, and a very good evening. Stand up.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.